Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series about the war on drugs, a war that I am sad to say we seem to be losing. Today, I want to explore a very deadly triangle: drugs, terrorism, and organized crime. To help me in this quest, I have a very, very special guest, D. Allen Johnson, or Dave to his friends, is a veteran private military contractor, a pilot by trade. He has operated in Central and South America, and also Africa, and I think some other far-flung places, but let's not get into those. He has been active in both the war on drugs and the war on terror. Dave, it is great to talk to you again. It seems like only yesterday we were talking. Oops, it was yesterday. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, actually, yesterday's program I thought was quite illuminating, that there was much food for thought, but it looked at only a very, very small part of this deadly triangle.
Yes, we got to peer into the corner of the Italian mafia, and there's several other flavors of mafia. Everybody knows about the Russians and the Dixie mafia and the Mexican mafia, but I was fascinated by that insider look.
Have you come across organized crime in other countries?
Oh yes, as undercover guy, I got to spend several days in the mansion of a Mexican mafioso down in San Luis Potosí, and that was quite illuminating. Very family oriented, good guy. He made a good living till he didn't pay off somebody, and the Mexican army came after him and blew his front door off with artillery. I had gone by then, and so he's in jail now. But yes, I've gotten to run in different organized crime.
Wow. And to our listeners, I do want to point out that our phone lines are open, and if any of you would like to ask us a question or make a comment, the number to call is 646-378-1120. Dave, the international drug trade is an incredibly complex one.
Right.
And you are probably closer to it than I am, and I'm not trying to implicate you as being involved. But I see it as a bit of a triangle. That there's drugs, there's terrorism, and there is organized crime. And those three entities form the three sides of the triangle. Would you buy into that idea?
Well, I do, and I think that you're right by mentioning drugs first, because if you looked at the triangle as an equal-sided triangle with drugs at the top, because the drugs provide money for all sorts of activities. The Underground Empire is a book that was written back in 1988 and provides a great insight into the money aspects and the financing of the drug business and how those proceeds are used. So the other two, terrorism and organized crime, would have a very difficult time without drug income. It is the basis for a lot of their international activities.
Drugs as far as I can see, are a bit like, you know, going to your local supermarket and peering in the produce department. We may pay a dollar for a head of lettuce. The grower gets maybe 5 cents.
Right.
Drugs seem to follow this same pattern. The poppy farmer or the coca farmer gets almost nothing. I mean, he's a subsistence kind of, or leads a subsistence life. The price and profits get exponentially larger as the drug wends its way to the streets of New York or Los Angeles or whatever. Dave, I know you've worked ops in both crops. How does the food chain actually work?
Well, if you start with the farmer, you know, you mentioned he hardly gets any money. And sometimes the farmer has no choice. Sometimes he is threatened by the drug cartel, and he is told what he will plant, how much he will plant, and how his fields will be guarded, and he is told what money, little bit, he will make off of it. You know, and it's hard to generalize because some guys have their own little business going and they can do a little better depending on who's the local warlord, and they exist all over the world. But if you think about the food chain as, you know, the for coca, for instance, it's grown on a bush that looks sort of like a holly bush. It's the leaves are shiny, and if you bend them, they'll break, and they have a little bit of a milky substance in those leaves. Those leaves are harvested and they're taken to a lab where they're broken up, and some sort of solvent, gasoline, acetone, are two of the favorites. If they can't get that, sometimes they use naphtha. They wash the leaves in that after they've broken them to get that sap out. And yeah, you think about the health implications of sniffing up the dried residue of gasoline into your nose. But anyway,
I would guess these areas are no smoking zones.
Well, actually, we have a lot of fires, and sometimes that's how you find a lab. Is a guy will show up at the hospital with 90% of his body burned by a flash fire, which is very characteristic of gasoline going up that's been, you know, vaporized in a small area. And you track back to where he came from. And, you know, we run psychological operations also, you know, trying to convince the bad guys that we have a lot more tools than what we have. One of my buddies was flying back from a mission, and he saw a big explosion in the jungle right under him. And he keyed the mic on his radio and said, "It worked, it worked." And all the guys that listened to our radio transmissions, you know, said, "Oh, these guys got a new weapon against us. They're blowing up our labs." But it was just somebody got careless. And so after they use the whatever type of solvent, they dry it, and what you have is a paste that's left. And that paste is typically transported to another lab where it's dried and cut, and different things are added to the powder. You never get really pure cocaine in. And like you say, the farmer, when he sells the leaves, which he has slaved to bring up the seedlings, clear the jungle, replant the seedlings as bushes and harvest those bushes and guard them, for several months, he gets almost nothing. The lab operator gets a pretty good cut, but the cartels are the ones that take over the paste, and they are the ones that are able to provide the transportation infrastructure and the guards and the political power to move those things across several countries. Bribery, extortion, threats are all used in addition to, you know, some secrecy and smuggling. But there's a lot more drugs that come in that are in an 18-wheeler, come across, never get inspected because they've got the handle on a U.S. Customs agent that they found out having an affair. This particular one I'm talking about was one of my dad's good friends, and found out that he had been letting the trucks come over because they blackmailed him. But then it gets to the guy on the street, and sort of like the guy that grows it, the guy on the street usually makes very little, and he's the one that peddles it to people and makes a little bit of money, but they're not the guys that get rich. It's the cartels.
So I don't know how good you are at math, but I'm guessing you're fairly good because you're a pilot, right? We're basically talking about a bell curve here.
Exactly.
Right. At the left end, we have the grower who makes nothing. We have the lab that makes, you know, a greater percentage. We have the cartel that obviously is making huge amounts of money.
The lion's share, that's right.
Right. And on the back side of the bell curve, we have the distribution network, and then finally the street seller.
Right. But, you know, once again, you've got to look at who puts up the money and who takes the financial risk. A lot of people don't realize how sophisticated these financial terms are that the cartels use to get their product, to buy jet aircraft and propeller aircraft and hire men that set up a little factory to build submarines to bring it to the U.S. There's several million dollars in overhead, not even counting the bribes that go to different political figures in several countries. So, you know, and this is a purely capitalistic enterprise, so you can see that bell curve pays for the people who put in the most time, expertise, and risk the most money.
We were talking yesterday about the mob, and I think it was Jack Garcia who said it. Hey, the mob's all about money. It's a business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm hearing about the drug trade.
Oh yes.
Right, the farmer isn't the addict, the
right.
Processor isn't the addict, the cartels probably don't use at all.
Very few.
Very few.
Yeah.
The distributors, yeah, maybe. Street sellers, almost certainly.
Yes.
And you start to see an interesting picture emerge. People are working for very small profits at the street seller level, that they're working for access rather than money.
Yeah, they're, you know, and they have they've limited themselves in their business by being users. And, you know, the legend on the street is you don't need to get an education because you can be a drug dealer. But the drug dealers without education, just like any, this is a trillion-dollar business. And if you don't have business skills, communication skills, people skills that come from an education, you'll never move up in that. And the street dealers hamper themselves both by being users and by being uneducated.
Okay, one of the things that's always bothered me is, you know, the poppy farmer or the coca farmer, he does it because it's a cash crop. But there have been a number of incentives to wean them off. Why have they failed?
You know, there's a lot of different reasons. One of the earliest efforts was USAID to industrial development, paid farmers to switch from coca to other crops. And this was done the first time in Peru. And we were currently spraying coca with armored spray planes at the time. And the bureaucrats felt like that, you know, the best thing for these guys to change over to would be green peppers. And that they switched over to green peppers. Well, a pilot running 100 miles an hour, you know, 15 feet off the ground looking for coca. Guess what? Green peppers have got green shiny leaves. They're about 3 feet high. Look just like coca. So these guys, when their pepper crop came close, they got sprayed and killed. Now, that's one reason that one didn't work. Another reason is, you know, these guys agree to switch over, and the drug lords come in after the conversion team moves off, and the drug lords tell them, nope, you're going to grow cocaine, or we're going to kill you and put somebody else on this land that will grow cocaine, grow coca. And so that's another. For the guys where the warlords allow them to make money, yes, money is then the operative word. And you can't make any generalizations because these different geographical bosses operate all over the spectrum, from being the kings and having just virtual slaves underneath them, to running one guy over in Afghanistan is famous for running his outfit like a democracy, and his farmers like partners. So yes, for them it's definitely money.
I was maybe oversimplistic in describing my triangle, because within the three corners are the other factor that the cartels. Why are they so hard to bring down?
Well, you know, for one thing, the Latin culture, even more than our culture, makes heroes out of villains. You know, I mean, like the Robin Hood syndrome.
Oh, in fact, on that very subject, have you been following the story out of Jamaica?
I can't talk about that one.
Okay, all righty.
Sorry.
But I guess you do know the story.
Anyway. Sorry, I should have warned you on that one.
My mistake. You carry on. We never mentioned the place.
Yeah, anyway. You know, we were talking about the other corners, the terrorism. Oh no, the cartels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Latin culture makes heroes out of these guys, and that is a historical thing that comes from them being oppressed by the Spaniards. This is what the sociologists say, anyway, when we get briefed on this, and so it's very difficult to get the locals to even inform on the guys. The cartels are smart. They contribute to churches. They build basketball courts and soccer fields and pay for people's hospital bills. They're smart. They get into into a community, and they are the good guys.
Hmm. Now, it seems to me that there are some countries, and I don't think we want to list them per se, but that they seem to let the cartels peacefully coexist. I mean, basically, the drug industry represents a shadow economy, but nonetheless, it's a huge economy. And without that money, countries would go broke.
It is an amazingly huge economy. And one of the ways to understand the business is forensic accounting, which is like, I think it was Tom Cruise said, follow the money.
Mm-hmm.
And you follow that money and you find out that these profits are reinvested. They're reinvested into real estate, into manufacturing, into resorts, and have resulted in a great number of people going straight after being in the drug business for just a few years, and now they're respected members of society. Some are even political leaders, and all because they washed their money, they used it to start businesses, and have been a large boon to their local economy. The smaller the nation, the bigger these kind of capital injections are to the country.
Yeah, in fact, I heard something very similar in a program I ran several weeks ago about organized crime here in the U.S. And it went along the lines of, "Hey, you got to do something with this money."
Yep.
And you know, a lot of it does get injected into real businesses. If we didn't have that money, those businesses wouldn't exist. Those jobs wouldn't exist. Those, you know, people would be out of work.
Yeah, there is a certain small city that was built from nothing to attract cruise ships, and since it's not provable, I can't mention the area, but it was,
it can't be Vegas, because Vegas isn't on the beach.
It has a fantastic, beautiful small city built in what was once a deserted cove, and it is gorgeous, and this kind of money was put in just out of nowhere, and provides a lot of jobs for locals, provides a place for these cruise ships to go and people to enjoy a piece of the Caribbean they've never seen before.
For some people, in fact, probably many people, the connection between drugs and terror is not one that they understand or can make. But I think it's fair to say that organizations like the Taliban obtain a great deal of their funding from the drug trade. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes. And, you know, there's a like a loose association around the globe of terrorists who produce drugs, like the Shining Path and the FARC in Colombia, and the groups that will sell those drugs using the profits to finance their operations. And that includes groups like the Russian Mafia, Chinese triads, and you know, we don't really talk about China's drug problem, nearly as big as ours, but and Al Qaeda, you know, we've proven that they've been buying cocaine in huge lots and smuggling it into Europe through their Muslim immigrants that live all over Europe, their idea not only to gain money, but to destabilize the European culture.
What is the favored method of smuggling drugs into Europe?
Well, that is a real good question, because we, just like in the Middle East, we don't have the right kind of people to get in to that culture. We don't have enough people that speak Arabic. We don't have enough people that understand the culture that can go in into that. But we know that the hop-off place is in Algeria, and that they use boats, and the boats go to several islands and ports all around the Mediterranean. But from there, we have lost it. And, we're just making excuses. Don't misunderstand me, but, the Arabs, the Muslims maintain a closed community in Europe. They have not assimilated very much. They continue to speak their home languages for the most part, and do a real good job of keeping their mouth closed.
Actually, Europe is an interesting area, because once you break that initial barrier, it's wide open.
Right.
So you've only got to break one barrier, and you have access to many countries. These organizations like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, they're not users, are they?
They are, number one, they're forbidden by their religion to be users. And they see the product as being worth much more than what it would give them pleasure. They get more pleasure from the money, and so they have it's been my argument that drug use comes from someone having an empty life, and these people have a purpose. They don't need or want drugs. They want every moment to be lucid and alert, moving toward their life's goal. And that's what one thing that we Westerners, we've got most of our life goals taken care of, or some people have none, and we look for escape.
Let's talk a little bit about the third line of the deadly triangle, and that's organized crime. Oh, and by that, I'm not necessarily referring to the mafia.
Right.
But organized crime means that there is a group of people that can handle the distribution at both wholesale and street level. Are the street gangs the people that are doing this, or is there a whole level of people that we don't know about?
Yeah, you've skipped at least two very important levels. The first one is going to be political, and these people will undermine individual lawmakers or leaders, and occasionally even an entire government, bend an entire government to their use. Because without a political base to grant passports, to help them launder money, to provide a safe haven, to provide land to grow if it's an agricultural-based product, then you've also skipped the intelligence level. The cartels and the Russian mafia, the Chinese triads spend a huge amount of effort and money and personnel on intelligence activities. It is very sophisticated and very successful. So then, you know, you have there's no regulation. So to enforce your territory, whether that territory is the land or you grow or your distribution channels, you've got to have an armed force of some type. You know, enforcers, soldiers, as the mafia talks about them. So you've skipped those three before you get into the financial and the guys that do what's called operations, which is the growing, transforming, distributing, and selling of the product. And then at the end, you have the money launderers. Some of the finest accountants and lawyers in the world work for the drug guys to launder and invest their money. Just like that book, The Firm, by Grisham, which is which is a highly accurate book. I'm surprised that that he got it published.
Yeah, it is an interesting look at the legal world.
Right.
Well, one of the things that I've discovered is that pretty much the cops are on top of what's going on. They should know who is doing the distributing. Or am I wrong?
No, they're, you know, a cop knows his area, and you know, I can't speak for the domestic police, but I have trained. I think I've mentioned to you, I used to work for the International Narcotics Law Enforcement Association, training police in Central America, and you get a guy that is gung-ho, he is a true believer, he's all in, and then you find out he's been letting these druggies go. And you know, what's the deal here? And you investigate it, that, you know, why is he letting these shipments through, or why is he letting these guys operate in his area? We thought this guy was really good. Come to find out, they've got his little sister, and they're holding her hostage. You know, that is the dangers of working and living in the same place. I have the advantage of working outside of my home. My wife is several thousand miles away from where I work, and that's a huge advantage for me. And so I can't speak to domestic, but that's what happens so often overseas. Everybody thinks these guys are bribed. No, these are good guys. These are upright guys, but they get into a position where no one can protect them because, you know, they don't know if their supervisor's on the take. They don't know if their supervisor is the real bad guy, and they can't afford to have their families killed.
I spent 6 years trying to help people. I ran a computer learning center out of a large homeless shelter.
Oh.
Place that slept 1,100 people a night.
Wow.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, we're not talking, you know, St. Joe's Church.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, you know, hands out two food packages a week. And I was incredibly well known in the city, but there certainly wasn't a homeless person that didn't know who Simon Barrett was. And to get to work, I would catch a bus and then hop a train across town, and I'd have a 4-block walk. And block 3 was actually an underpass, that there was a big road that, you know, went over. And every morning I would see the same people smoking the same marijuana, smoking the same crack.
Yeah.
And they could care less. They knew that, you know, if I turned them in, they'd be toast. They didn't care.
Wow.
Even stranger, though, were the local cops. I would quite often see a cop car cruise by, and it was very apparent what these people were doing, but, you know, the cops just turned a blind eye. It was almost as if, oh, we could care less. There's no point in busting these people. You know, they've got no money. If we bust them, all that's going to happen is we're going to have to fill out the paperwork. We're going to have to feed and house them. You know, let this homeless shelter deal with it. And to me, that was the wrong thing to be doing.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of deals with the devil that are made on things like that. You know, you turn in a big guy and I'll let you hang out here and do this, you know, and you don't know if there's any of that going on. And believe me, I would never speak badly about a street officer. It's the hardest job in the world, one of the most dangerous. And like you say, they are put under some unbelievable stresses from, you know, prosecutors that say we don't want to handle this, we've got too big a caseload, or maybe it's a judge that doesn't want to see any more of these. You know, who knows? Maybe after several years, you just get discouraged. But yeah, you're right. That shouldn't happen. But there's got to be some reason, because the great majority of police officers are upright people.
Yeah, in fact, this particular city, every July, it had a huge world-attracting deal that went on, and about 2 weeks before it started, they'd be a sweep. They'd they'd pick up all the prostitutes. They pick up all of the street corner drug dealers, just clean it up so that, you know, the visitors didn't see it.
Right.
But, I mean, week after the event ended, oh, it was just business as usual. But
yeah.
It does bother me. Obviously, the key to fixing the drug problem is dealing with the people at the top of the bell curve. And yet, we don't seem to be seeing much of that. You know, yeah, they bust the street corner dealer sometimes. They bust the addict sometimes, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of activity in going after the big guys.
Yeah, you know, they've got a lot of protection. They've got we have had getting close to people before and gotten calls from high up elected officials telling us, you back off of that one, go somewhere else. And, you know, high cover, we call it. And that comes from the political and their intelligence function. You know, they've either got a guy paid off or they've got some kind of lever on one of these top guys. And it's a sad thing that, but these big guys are smart. They are smart. And they prepare. And, well, that's all I'll say about that.
You know, as someone that is at the sharp end of the stick, shall we say, I mean, does it frustrate you?
Yes, it does. It does. But, you know, my hope, you know, you're talking about attacking guys at the top. My hope is that if we can slow this importation of drugs down and educate our kids and give them a life goal, that our society will mature past this infatuation with drugs into one where people are more concerned about each other, they're more concerned about their world and not escaping their world, having a purpose in life. And this without the user, the drug business will dry up to nothing. My goal is to just hold it back for a couple of years so that our society does not disintegrate, so that hopefully, like a teenager, we'll grow past that. You know, just, I've had teenagers, you know, their brains do come back, and I'm hoping that that's how our society is right now.
So you're essentially saying that, you know, you feel that the key is in the education.
Yes, the education, and even more than education, because there's many highly educated drug users, people that have a purpose, people that have dedicated their life to a better environment, have dedicated their life to their religion, have dedicated their life to a better political system, whatever that is, that they would have a goal or a purpose and fill up that empty space in their soul that they've been trying to fill with drugs.
Okay, how do we educate these people?
Oh.
What would be your idea?
Oh, you know, if you had asked me this before I had children, I would have been able to tell you everything. Now that I've gone through two teenagers, I realize the extent of my ignorance. You know, that is a... I'll have to think on that. And maybe we'll have a show on that one. But I don't have a good answer for you right now.
Okay, it just seems to me that, you know, we've had the DARE program, you know, where police drop in at local schools and put on presentations, and you know, it's all good,
right?
And don't get me wrong, but it doesn't seem to be very effective.
Yeah, I think it's because it's juvenile. We have not called our kids to a purpose. You know, you try to scare them, and that's what you do with a 3-year-old. You know, but when once your kids get older, which I think our society is maturing, you've got to give them something. You know, a call to a purpose of, you know, we're going to remake our cities, this inner urban blight. You know, we're going to bring the underclass into U.S. society, something big, something that can engage people. And, you know, I'm just a ground pounder. I'm just a soldier in the war on drugs. That's for somebody higher up to think of that program.
Well, the one thing I do know is that everything I've seen to date hasn't worked.
Right.
I don't know why, but, you know, but there again, we can't even stop young children, you know, deciding to take up smoking. Well, incidentally, I happen to be smoking at the moment. But, you know, but I am in my mid-50s. I have my excuses.
Well, you know, it is a perhaps a symptom of our affluence, that we no longer have to worry about where the next meal's coming from, and because you don't see much drug use in countries that have no disposable income.
Right, and you don't see a great deal of drug use in the countries that are producing.
Right.
And, that again, gives me pause for thought. How come? You'd think that, if the product's on your doorstep and likely much, much cheaper than, what we can buy it for here in the U.S., why don't people use it? Well, maybe there is a reason. And, maybe it's based on historical fact. Oh, drugs are bad.
Well, the historical use of coca, for instance, is to make tea. And this tea has you get a little bit of that cocaine effect, which is about the same as the caffeine from coffee. And it is legal to use coca leaves to drink coca tea in South America. And it's very, very good for altitude sickness if you're climbing mountains. And that's what it's mostly used for locally. And there are people that have licenses to grow coca for coca tea. And that's highly regulated. And of course, we can't drink it. We bust our next drug test, But so I can't tell you what it's like. But that's how they use coca leaves.
Are we winning this war?
I am like the ant that's climbing the tree. I'm too close to tell you if we're doing any good. That needs someone that is a more disassociated observer. From what I've seen, we have disconnected the drug flow from a couple of organizations. I can't mention their name right now, and we've been very successful at that. And several countries in Central and South America have benefited over the last 10 years. All you have to do is look at the changes in their gross domestic products, the changes in their amount of people that have graduated high school. And so in my personal battles, I'm very proud of what we've done and think that we've been a great success in my theater of operations. The overall thing, I can't speak to that.
Okay, let's take an absolutely shameless commercial break. Dave, you have two books out there. Tell us about them and where people can find them.
Okay, the first one is How to Get a Job in the War on Terrorism. And I've written this job guide to people that are interested in doing the type of work that I do. And if someone is interested in working in a job where you feel like you can change history, if you're interested in a job where you can make six-figure income and have 4 to 6 months off a year, then buy my ebook. It's on Amazon.com, and it talks about the things that you need to know, the people you need to talk to, and some of the keys that no one will ever tell you that are looked for in someone that is a private military contractor.
You also include a number of personal anecdotes that I have to admit I did enjoy.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I'm trying to give somebody a flavor of what the work might entail. And, you know, I'm getting old, so that those stories are not quite what would happen today. There'd be a little different theater of operations. But still, you know, the first private military contractors that I hung out with, there were guys that started working for the U.S. government in the late 40s over in China and Indochina. And those guys were my mentors. And their stories are sort of like mine, just a different venue and a little bit different equipment. But yes, it's a job that is going to continue to be in demand.
In fact, you started in 88, as I recall.
86.
86.
Right.
Sorry, I do apologize. And your big boss was Oliver North.
That's right. Yeah, I was taking supplies to the Contras in Nicaragua, and that was my first sort of the changing the guard. That was the last mission for these guys that started right after World War II, and it was some of our first missions, are the new generation. And I'm getting a little long in the tooth right now, and we're bringing in some new guys, the change of the guard has started.
A question I've always wanted to ask you, and I keep forgetting. How on earth did you get involved in it?
Well, it was an accident. I got out of high school. I'd always wanted to be a soldier. I went into the U.S. Army, became a paratrooper. When I got out, I was interested in flying, learned how to fly, and I went to my first job interview. I just walked in cold and told this guy I wanted to go to work for him. And he looked at my resume, and he said, "Well, son, I really don't have a place for you, and you're awfully young. You don't have any experience, and I really don't think I can use you." And he's scanning down my one-page resume, which doesn't have much on it. He gets down to the bottom, and he says, "82nd Airborne, huh?" I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "You know, I was light weapons infantry in the 11th Airborne back in 1955. And he throws my resume to the side and said, "When can you start?" Found out that guy was the retired chief pilot for Air America. And he was running a little charter operation. Figured that he had completely retired from the business of working for the U.S. government. It was, if you remember right, right at the end of the Carter era, there was no work going on then. Reagan came to power a couple of years later, and this guy that was my boss, I'd been working for him about 6 years, got called to be the chief pilot on this operation for Oliver North. And he says, "Dave, you want to go?" And I said, "Well, you know, I can't leave till tomorrow." So found myself in Miami working for Southern Air Transport the next day. A week later, I'm doing airdrops in Nicaragua.
And you haven't looked back from then?
Yeah, found out that this business, you know, in the past was an Army mafia. It's changing a little bit, but it used to be all Army. And that's because the first guy that the agency hired was Claire Chennault, who ran the Flying Tigers over in China in World War II. He was an Army officer, and he felt like Airborne Army was the best guys to get for this kind of work.
Mm-mm-mm. Okay, and you have another book out.
Yes, I've written a novel about a warlord in Africa that establishes his own little kingdom in the southeast corner of Congo. And he has financed his kingdom by expropriating some mines, and he's mining a strategic mineral there that the U.S. government and several Western corporations want to get their hands on. And they hire some mercenaries and some contractors, which, by the way, there is a difference, to retake those mines. And the story is about a mercenary pilot, a missionary, and the wife of the warlord, and how they survive the clash.
Okay, you just said something incredibly interesting, and it's a subject that I've kind of avoided when I've been talking with you. What is the difference between a mercenary and a contractor?
Well, a mercenary is an age-old occupation. Goes back to the first mercenaries we find recorded, or about 2000 BC, the Hirshites in Egypt, working for the Egyptian army. And what a mercenary is a person who fights for a foreign government for money. A contractor, number one, does not fight. We do jobs that free up soldiers, so we can't be mercenaries because we are either security guards or we are pilots, mechanics, intelligence analysts. We do things that free up soldiers so they can fight. And the other thing is, we don't fight for a foreign government. We work for our own government. So we're not mercenaries. Mercenaries fight. They're on the front lines. So in other words, if I enlisted in the French Foreign Legion to fight for France as a soldier, I'm a mercenary. But flying as a pilot for the Department of Defense, I'm a contractor. I am working for pay to do a non-combat job. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does. Do you ever find yourself in a potentially combat situation?
Well, we're fired upon occasionally, but we're not allowed to carry weapons. And our typical mission profile is that once the shooting starts, we leave the area. And the active duty guys come in. And then when they finish and the shooting dies down, we'll come back and do assessments or cleanups or whatever our job is.
So I think I'm going to say this to our listeners. While I can highly recommend Dave's book, How to Get a Job in the War on Terror, you do have to understand that occasionally people point guns at you.
Well, yeah, but, you know, that happens to bus drivers in Detroit also.
Right. I just knew you'd have a comeback.
Well, you know, I had several of my friends die in their late 30s and early 40s. You know, they were accountants and air traffic controllers and truck drivers, you know, and that stress just killed them.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Dave, you waged the war on drugs on foreign soil. Should we pull back and wage that war around the borders of the U.S.?
That is a very tough question, because I think in our own self-interest that might work, but our foreign policy is that we help our allies, and I think in our drug war, we have definitely helped our allies. And like I said, in my theater of operations, it's been extremely successful. And this is not a America-only thing. The drug war is a worldwide conflict against people that are using this income to do bad things. It's not just that they're selling drugs to us. It's all tied together.
You know, I watched the news, and 2 years ago, I had very vaguely heard of a place called Juarez, Mexico. Today, I watch the TV and I hear Juarez, and I go, oh God, how many people died last night?
Right.
I mean, you know, it's a war zone on the border.
Oh yes, it's you know, you what you're seeing here is the movement of huge amounts of money, unbelievable amounts of money. One of the things, I don't know if you heard, they found a house, 3-bedroom, 2-bath house, about 1,800 square feet. And you couldn't go in the house because every room was completely full of money, completely full to the ceiling.
Damn, I want to rent it.
Yes. Well, this is just an indicator of the type of money that is flowing through Mexico right now. And you're seeing the enforcement arms of the cartels battling for control. And it's messy. It's dirty. But there is so much money that they believe it's worth it. And it's a combat zone, and it's spilling over into the United States.
Oh, indeed. In fact, I watched a segment about some of the border towns, and it was border towns on the U.S. side, and just how much a hit they were taking from an economic standpoint.
Right.
You know, no one wanted to cross the border. Companies are going out of business. Drugs maybe the big money, but they're killing a lot of legitimate business people as well.
That's exactly right. The tourism is really off. You know, that whole border area gets snowbirds every winter that go down there and live. Some of them in motorhomes and some rent apartments. This last winter was horrible in comparison. There are still quite a few, but not anything like before. The colleges have a much harder time recruiting people that in South Texas and along the Arizona and New Mexico borders for all those reasons. And those kind of economic hits filter all the way through.
Although this has nothing to do with the war on drugs at all, I'm sure you've been following the developments in Arizona and their recent change in the law.
Right.
That's got to be hurting the Arizona economy no end.
Well, you know, that they're being boycotted. On the other hand, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with their outflow for social services and schools and things like this. What I'm hoping to see is that if they can get people, you know, all these jobs that they say Americans will not do, Americans will do if they're paid. And, you know, a $25 an hour Mason, the U.S. Mason, can't find work in Arizona because a skilled Mason from Mexico will do the same work for $10 an hour. And I want to see Americans who are unemployed get those jobs at correct wages. And I think that will spur the economy. And don't get me wrong, I'm a conservative, but the Republican Party has prostituted itself out to big business that wants to hire illegals as slave labor. It's wrong. And I think this is one of the things that will give some jobs back to Americans.
Now, I've lived in both Arizona and California, and a lot of the quote slave labor was backbreaking work,
right,
working in the fields, and that's $5 an hour job, picking lettuce or whatever the crop may be. You're not going to find Americans to do that.
Well, not for that price, you won't.
Right, but you know, if you pay them $25 an hour, boy, watch your grocery bill go up at the local supermarket.
Well, you know, that is discounting the ability of automated harvesters. And
mm-hmm.
every time that there has been a labor shortage, some guys come up with some type of automated harvester. And that's the deal. Can we get people cheap enough to where we don't have to buy the machinery? And, some of it doesn't exist right now because they know they can get $5 an hour people to pick lettuce. You know, and some of those machines, like if you've ever watched a potato harvester.
Yes, I have.
Yes.
They're amazing.
Exactly. And who would have thought that they would have been able to dig potatoes out of the ground and harvest them without damaging it? And it's the same thing. You know, but there's some inventor that's starving. I don't buy this that we're going to all starve to death if we enforce our border laws.
Dave, we're just about out of time. Do you have any parting thoughts for us?
Well, I'm hopeful that American society will wean themselves off of drugs and not go the perceived easy route of legalization, which would lead, I feel, to more dependence and would lead the bad guys to just move into something else, because bad guys are bad guys. They don't change just because whatever they're doing now is made legal. We saw that in Holland.
Right. In fact, we saw that yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah, they stole all of our fun things. You know, the numbers game. Wow.
Yeah.
States turned that into the lottery.
Right.
Dave, it is always wonderful to talk to you, and I do hope that we will be talking again soon.
Okay, sir. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. This is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network, wishing everyone a wonderful afternoon, and I'm sure we'll all talk again soon. Goodbye.